Our podcast this week, we're joined by genius writer, novelist, Twitter legend, and English god, Neil Gaiman. Plus, all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that is delighted to report that Helen O'Hara is alive and well. She's finished. She's done a run. Amazing. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, brought to you as ever by those mustard peeps at mustard.co.uk. If you want car insurance compared, these guys are the best on the meerkat, the market. Anyway, yes, Helen is alive. She absolutely is. She went off the grid for a little bit, but only because she was running up mountains and whatnot in Nepal. But she has finished. She will be back on the podcast next week to tell us the full story. Extraordinary stuff. You can still sponsor her on her Virgin Money page, so take a look at that. In the meantime, this week I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our online editor, a man who would only run up a mountain if that mountain were made out of West Wing box sets. It's James Dyer.
Hello.
That's not true, is it? You actually have run up a mountain, haven't you?
I'm climbing Scaffold Pike, actually. I'm walking up Scaffold Pike in a few weeks.
What is Scaffold Pike?
It's like a hill.
Where is it? Not to
it's a mountain up north somewhere.
You're going up north.
Yeah, it's terrifying. I'm going beyond the wall. There'll be wildlings. I'm basically becoming first ranger of the Empire Office.
It's in the Lake
District. The sword in the darkness.
Right. It's in the Lake District.
It is. Yes, it is.
It's one of the scenic and bucolic parts of the country.
Yes, I'm going to hike up it. Right. Actually, to be fair, I've hiked near Mount Doom. I did the Tongariro.
That's what I was alluding to.
Yes, I did the Tongariro crossing in New Zealand, where you walk. You don't go up Mount Doom. I don't think you're allowed to because I think it's like in a protected reserve or something. But you could see it from where I walked. And so I like to pretend I was like a one-man fellowship. Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Did you approach anyone and say, I can't carry it, but I can carry you?
That would have been... probably put me on some kind of register if I'd done that. I don't think that would have been a good idea. But yeah, it was... yes. I did not know the way. They had my axe, etc., etc. It was good. It was nice.
There we go. You've already heard his voice, but the other colleague of such lethal cunning is, of course, our art house guru, a man who doesn't run up mountains. He drags boats across them. It's Phil Dissemblian. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Yeah? Good?
How are you?
Yeah.
What do you mean, yeah?
I'm all right.
You'll do better than that.
Yeah.
Come on.
I'm great.
Okay, good.
I'm absolutely fine and dandy.
It's good to hear, Chris.
It's all good. Welcome both.
Thanks.
Should we have a question?
Yeah.
So our question this week comes from Twitter. Just put a shout out for questions, and Damien Knight on Twitter responded with a very, very simple one. This probably ties into one of the films we're going to be talking about this week, which is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. What would be your favourite sci-fi planet to live on?
So specifically to live, not just to, you know, for a mini break.
No. To live.
Oh.
Endor looks nice.
Technically, it's a moon. But yeah, let's let it go. No, Endor's nice. It's foresty. So it's quite green.
Clarify something for me here. It's constantly referred to as the forest moon of Endor, right? Yeah. So is Endor the planet and the moon is an unnamed moon, as our moon is, or is Endor the name of the moon?
I believe it's the... You know what? That's a very good point, because it's ambiguous. The forest moon of Endor could imply both. This is one of these things where, as someone who has probably studied the hologram in more detail than is socially acceptable, I should know the answer to that, and I don't. I'm going to look it up while you speak.
All right. Good, good, good. So, Phil, you'd go and live on Endor?
I'd live on Endor.
Yeah?
Yeah, it looks like Berkshire. With fewer Waitroses.
Yeah.
Waitry. Yeah, Endor looks nice.
I would need Waitry. I would need to be in touch with some sort of technology. It's always great when you go away for a weekend break and you're removed from... I went somewhere the other week. I went to... give this Michelin star restaurant a quick plug. I stayed at the Black Swan at Oldstead, which is Tommy Banks, a brilliant Michelin star chef. I stayed at his hotel / restaurant with, my wife. And it was amazing. But... completely in the sticks, and had no Wi-Fi, had no phone reception for a day and a half, and I was crawling up the walls. I just needed to tell people terrible jokes on Twitter, and I couldn't. And I think being an Endor would be a bit like that. You wouldn't be able to nip down the shops or pop into HMV or Game to look at things that you're never going to buy.
Unlike on which sci-fi planets that you're about to mention.
I'm going to jump in here and say the verdict is in. Wikipedia says Endor, also known as Tana among the Ewok species, was the cyan gas planet orbited by the forest moon of Endor. So the planet is called Endor, and the moon is a forest moon.
There we go. We have cleared it up. We've cleared it up. Fantastic.
But apparently, as a side note, the name, inverted commas, Endor, was also sometimes used for the forest moon. So Wikipedia doesn't have a clue.
So we're fine then.
Yeah, we're fine. We can say whatever we like.
So I can move there.
So it's like calling the moon Earth. You can't do that.
No, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that.
Whilst we're on semantics, Alex Proyas' Dark City, does that count as a planet? Not that you necessarily want to live there. It's just a sort of noirish nightmare.
I think
crimescape.
So. Yeah, it is a bit like living in a detective novel. Mm. Yeah, I think so. But it'd be a hell of a commute, wouldn't it? Because it's just one big city. Like Coruscant, for example. Okay. Also another city planet.
Does Coruscant have any parks? Does it have any green spaces? I mean, most cities have to have a designated park or green place that Mad Max goes to. Just to, you know, try and have some sort of semblance of ecological well-being. Like, we're trying to put something back into the atmosphere here.
It doesn't strike me as a planet signed up to the climate accords.
I mean, it must absolutely stink, Coruscant. It must have smog levels off the charts. It's crazy. But on the other hand, lots of Waitry, lots of HMVs, mm-hmm. lots of games.
Yeah.
Not so much Woolworths. Even Woolworths has crashed on Coruscant. But yeah, I'd be excited by that. That'd be good.
Grab a cheeky Nando's on the way to the Senate. Yeah, yeah. Good.
We saw Alien last night.
We did.
On the big screen in 70, glorious 70mm, slightly tinged pink.
With a really annoying clicking sound coming from the rear left speaker, which is obviously another feature of the print, which drove me insane throughout the film. But it was.
Did it?
Was
I thought there was the first print had a heartbeat type thing. It was like boom. Boom, boom,
yeah.
As the print was rolling around, I thought it really added to the tension of the film. But you wouldn't want to live on LV-426, would you?
No.
I mean, in either of its forms, it seems pretty inhospitable.
It is inhospitable. I quite like the idea of, I mean, you wouldn't, like Arrakis, otherwise known as Dune, nice, deserty, probably warm, a little bit arid, lots of worms.
Okay.
So, interesting wildlife, probably not somewhere you want to live unless you want to become a Fremen.
What about Barsoom?
Ooh, Barsoom, otherwise known as Mars. My Jeddak is rusty.
I don't know if I want to live on Mars because I don't really fancy eating a bunch of spuds that I've grown in my own shit.
Yeah, well, that's true. You could jump very high.
Yeah, I could jump very high, but on the other hand, the diet would be a little bit one-dimensional.
I mean,
not a big fan of that.
No.
But I just have to keep going back to Star Wars for this. I mean, there are some beautiful looking planets in Star Wars. Wouldn't want to live in Coruscant necessarily because as I do sometimes, need to go to a green place. Mm-hmm. But I would like Alderaan looks lovely. The few glimpses we get of it in the Star Wars the movies, Naboo. It gets a lot of crap,
yes, Naboo,
Naboo
is
but
nice.
It's a lovely, lovely place.
You can ride on the giant inflatable cows.
We can, yeah. we can roll around the fields and we can go and have some lovely conversations with the Gungans. This would be a good place to be. Sandar and Guardians looks like a nice place. It's technological, but also pretty, pretty sweet.
Now, in Guardians 2, there's a prostitution planet. So depending on your proclivities, I guess it's the intergalactic Las Vegas. So that's a thing.
Yeah, what's it called?
I can't remember.
Croaxia or something like that? Yeah, I've forgotten. I should have written this stuff down.
Where do they end up in We Need Helen Here? It's not the first time we've said that in the last few weeks, is it? Battlestar Galactica. Uh-huh. What's the planet that they...
That they end up on?
It's Earth,
it's
isn't
called
it?
Earth.
Oh, that's right.
You'll be quite familiar with that. Spoiler. Yes, they end up on Earth. Yeah, it's that in the final episode of the entire series.
Okay, so that doesn't count.
No, probably not. Although,
if
we're
traveled...
going TV, I would say every single holiday anyone ever takes on Star Trek ends up on a planet called Risa, where there are lots of sort of alien pastry models leading you around the place. It's a pleasure planet, and they all go there, everyone. So that's a thing. Okay. Better than the penal asteroid Aurora Pente, unless you want to go skiing. So, you know.
How are you spelling penal? Any other Star Trek planets?
Oh, well, Farpoint Station, which is the one from the... Well, it's not a planet, it's a space station, but it's the one where anything you desire just materialises.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say, I really want that Game of Thrones Season 6 steelbook, it would materialise on top of your Blu-ray player.
You need to really ratchet up your hopes and dreams. That's the one thing. You'd go to this planet, you'd go, I want a Game of Thrones steelbook.
To be fair, it hasn't a Dolby Atmos sound mix. It's pretty good.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's is that a good jumping off point for people who haven't seen Game of Thrones?
Yes, you should definitely watch it.
Drop in, Dolby Atmos, Game of Thrones. Yeah. What do you want?
Available
Phil,
now.
If you could go to Farpoint, you could have anything you wanted. Would you want Game of Thrones season 5? What do you want? What do you want? Inferno Hearts
Game of Thrones
set?
Season 7, surely.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, set your sights high. Good.
That's then I could come and spoil it for you, James.
Yes, you could.
That's a good question. Could you have something that hasn't been made yet? Could you go to this planet and go, I want to see Avengers 4? And then it would appear. It would appear before you. Could you do that?
Well, yes, because the alien life form that they have enslaved turns your mental wishes into physical things.
But then it becomes my version of what Avengers 4 is, rather than what Avengers 4 would be.
Yeah.
So it would be me.
So it would
as
be
Tony
you.
Stark.
As, yeah, exactly that. Yeah. Exactly that. And your Game of Thrones season 7 would be you as Tony Stark. It's just the same thing.
Yeah. Just I've heard there's a Stark in Game of Thrones. That's all I know.
It's
so
Tony.
I assume it's him. That'd be a cool place to go to. Lost in Paradise and Fifth Element. That's not necessarily a planet, but I really like that version of Earth, by the way. I know it's crowded in the big Coruscant, but I it's just something cool about that. Cooler than the Blade Runner version of Earth. But I would like to live... I'd like to live in Naboo, and I'd like to have a conversation with Jar Jar Binks, because he's much maligned, his old Jar Jar.
He go on safari there?
Probably.
Or on...
Try and hunt him down.
Yeah.
It's like Predator, but with an inept person at the centre of it.
That would be genius.
That would be amazing.
I would pay to see this film. Go to Cybertron. That would be fun.
Can we have this conversation without me referencing the oceanic planet of Solaris?
No, we can't.
Apparently not.
Go on.
No.
Go on.
I'm not sure that's a place you necessarily want to spend a lot of time, would you?
Mm.
Where you're visited by manifestations of past tragedies on an almost daily basis. It's not Tahiti, but it looks nice from a distance.
It's not.
It looks nice. It's sort of, oceanic.
Well, this kind of leads into a thing that Helen's, I think, talked about before. She has a thing where all science fiction planets only have one ecosystem. You know, they're all one thing. It's either a desert planet or an ice planet. It can't just be a planet with variable weather.
Oh. That's what I liked about Avatar. I think you get the sense of Avatar that planet, what the hell is it called?
Pandora.
Pandora, thank you. We want to go there? Do you want to live on Pandora?
Everything there is trying to kill you. It's the science fiction equivalent of Australia.
This is true. I don't know if I want to live in Pandora, but it does. I mean, in that James Cameron, within that film, we'll be talking more about Avatar in a few minutes, wanted, you could clearly see that he was trying to show that there are different aspects to that planet. It's, because it's in London, you can go 5 minutes and suddenly the weather changes and everything changes and the landscape changes. And but Star Wars, I mean, George Lucas in particular, did set out to make, this is a desert planet, this is an ice planet, this is a water planet, this is a planet with the big mountains, this is a sinkhole planet, this is a planet where the hairy people live, this is a forest moon, and there wasn't much diversity. But I think that's fine. That's okay. Only, of course, this is the big city planet. I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
Do not all the planets revolve around a sun of some description?
They do.
Would that not affect their ecosystems?
It probably would.
We're getting technical in ways that we're not equipped to deal with.
That few people other than Christopher Nolan really think it through to the level.
Yeah.
Probably not.
It's true.
Christopher Nolan does, though.
SETI Alpha 5.
Yes. This is SETI Alpha 5.
Not a good place to be.
Not really.
Great earworms, though. Right. Okay, that's it. Thank you for your question, Damien Knight. If you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast, we've already got one for next week. Very apt one. But I won't reveal what it is. But if you want to have your question read out in the Empire podcast while Phil drops something into a coffee cup, do tweet us. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us as well, Empire Magazine. And you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. I think that's where we got next week's question from, via email. All very, very exciting. Right. Let's move on and let's talk about movie news. And there's only really one place to start, and that is with the really, really sad news that broke yesterday, that the great director Jonathan Demme passed away at the age of just 73. Amazing, amazing director. Phil, you interviewed Demme, didn't you?
I did. I interviewed him for one of my first ever interviews for Rachel Getting Married, which is a film I think still kind of one of my favourite kind of surprise indies in my time here. And I was probably, visibly nervous because it was early days.
Oh, was it in person?
In person, yeah.
Okay.
He was there with Robin Hitchcock, who was partly responsible, I think, for the soundtrack of that film. And I believe it had cameoed in another of his movies, although I can't remember off the top of my head which one. And he was, Jonathan Demme was just a delight to meet and to talk to. I thought that film had, like, he'd had a sort of reasonably low profile going into that movie. And, you know, he was talking about doing documentaries. He'd obviously had that kind of rich tradition of music docs. And I think he was thinking about going back and doing something after that, maybe Bob Marley, if memory serves. But he was an absolute delight. And obviously, conversation inevitably was always going to turn Silence of the Lambs with him. I imagine he spent his whole kind of latter part of his career talking about that film. But I saw it again recently, and it's such a great film. It really does stand up. One of the kind of most memorable film-going experiences in the, I don't know if it's still at the Odeon Marble Arch, queuing to see it, feeling trepidation. And he was just a really versatile and brilliant and probably underrated filmmaker. Cut his teeth with Roger Corman, like a lot of the greats, James Cameron and many others. And he was just really adaptable. He could do all kinds of things. Stop Making Sense, his Talking Heads concert doc, is probably still the high watermark in that kind of arena, as it were. Really brilliant work. And his kind of creative gelling with David Byrne from Talking Heads was a form of alchemy. You know, Married to the Mob, there was very little he couldn't do. And aside from that, if you look at all of the kind of tributes that have flown in, sort of come in on social media over the last 24 hours, there's a real affection for him as a man as well, clearly. People really liked him. He was a warm, generous spirit. I could tell that in that sort of half an hour I had with him, that he was not a man that was kind of burdened with too much ego. He shrugged off wanting to talk too much about, you know, Oscars and things like that he'd been through with Silence. But a lovely guy, and yeah, a real shame, because I think he had, felt like we've said this a few times recently, but I felt like he had more really impressive films in him. So for that reason, as well as all the others, it's really sad news.
He did a fantastic interview with Empire's Ian Nathan, where he talked through pretty much all his major films, which ran in September 2015, and we put that up on the website yesterday if anyone wants to check it out.
Yeah, fantastic director, and you were right, incredibly versatile, and his love of music clearly such a huge part of his life. He would make music documentaries and concert films and work with all sorts of people. But I thought he was just a tremendous, one of those directors you can't pin down. You know what I mean? Like, he just flits around from genre to genre and from subject matter to subject matter. Silence of the Lambs is obviously the big one. That's the one everyone's going to gravitate towards, and rightly so. It's brilliant. One of the only films to get the big five: best picture, best director, best actor, best actress, and best screenplay, of course. Is a great, great film. Notable, of course, for Tony Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter, and everything that came after that. But I really love Something Wild. Something Wild is fantastic. If you haven't seen Something Wild, it's a great, blackly comedic thriller that takes a really nasty turn about halfway through when Ray Liotta. It's a lovely, lovely, capricious rom-com with Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith. And then suddenly Ray Liotta turns up as this psycho host beast ex, and it just, it turns nasty in a really interesting way. And it's a dark, fun, kinetic ride. And he could just, you know, he was just a very interesting guy, you know. It's interesting what happened to him after Silence of the Lambs, and he made Philadelphia, and obviously Tom Hanks won the Oscar, and that was a very, very important film as well. And it took 5 years to make Beloved, and then he did The Truth About Charlie, and I think that hurt his career a little bit, that ill-fated remake of Charade. Or Charade, whatever way you want to say it. But it was interesting. He wasn't as prolific as you would want. You know, you would want more Jonathan Demme movies from a very purely selfish viewpoint, but the ones he made were very interesting. And I imagine even if you went back and revisited The Truth About Charlie, there's probably more in there to gnaw upon than perhaps it was given credit for at the when it first came out.
Do you think so?
Maybe. I'm just guessing. You know, it's like, he seems like one of those directors who would be incapable of making an uninteresting film.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Even something, you know, Ricky and the Flash which was his last film now. But it seems like a throwaway film, but there's stuff there to chew upon, and really fun performances and a really fun soundtrack. And I imagine The Truth About Charlie has something as well. But But it has to come down to the grey films. The grey films are Something Wild, Stop Making Sense, Silence of the Lambs, and Married to the Mob, I think is really, really cool as well, and Philadelphia. All good stuff.
I think those are the ones, but yeah. I would put a, you know, when we talk about Jonathan Demme, he had a way of like reducing things, like all great filmmakers do, to the nub of to their essence. You know, people have tweeted that shot from Silence of the Lambs with Jodie Foster in the lift in a grey sweatshirt, surrounded mm-hmm. by men towering above her, which kind of just cut the themes of that film right down to their essence in one fell swoop with no dialogue. And I just want to put a shout out to people who haven't seen Rachel Getting Married, that it's a film partly about grief, might be a nice one to revisit. And that has a scene in it with, I think, Bill Irwin as the dad. They have a scene in the kitchen where the family's all gathered for this marriage. There's a ghost in the room, and there's a dishwasher loading competition, which ends in a really heartbreaking kind of expression of grief. And it's a brilliant scene. And very honest, and it's a real shame that he won't be making more.
Absolutely, such a shame indeed. 73 years old, passed away yesterday, the great Jonathan Demme. And we also mentioned earlier in the show, obviously, James Cameron and Avatar, and this broke last week. After we went to Pod, we don't go to press with podcasts, we would go to Pod, that the Avatar sequels are happening. Yeah. And not only are they happening, they've been given release dates. December 18th, 2020 for Avatar 2. I'm sure these won't be the names. December 17th, 2021 for Avatar 3. Then there's a 3-year break. That's interesting. For films that are meant to be shot back to back. I imagine there's a lot of stuff that's going to go on in between those two. December 20th, 2024. And if you want to know where you're going to be on December 19th, 2025, 8 years, 8.5 years hence, mm-hmm. Chances are you're going to be at the, well, will cinemas still exist in 8.5 years?
You'll be having this film beamed into your skull.
Yeah, that's where you're going to
be. Is Avatar 5 being released on Netflix, as you said?
It's amazing.
It is funny. I think it's an odd thing to make these... I mean, look, they're placeholders, aren't they? It's not set in stone. But it's an odd thing to plan that far in advance when, I mean, frankly, looking at the news we make, none of us be here. But
that's a very good point.
It's, yeah. I don't know. Look, I love everything that Cameron's ever done. I think he's an absolute genius, and he doesn't make bad movies, and he rarely makes bad decisions, so I'm not one to ever sort of throw shade in his direction. But an Avatar is obviously the most profitable film of all time, but it's profitable due to a very specific sort of conjunction of events. You know what I mean? It was a film that came out, it was him coming back, it was a very specific, you know, multi-quadrant project, but it hit with the resurgence of 3D. I mean, it caused the resurgence of 3D. And I think that is responsible for the sort of breadth of its box office returns. Everyone saw this film, was like, you've got to see this in 3D. 3D is amazing. 3D is the most exciting new thing, even though it wasn't new. And now, obviously, everyone is over 3D. I think it's fairly safe to say. You know, mm-hmm. we'll watch it occasionally. It's not necessarily a bad thing. Some films that are shot in 3D look really good, but nobody's thinking that it's changing their lives.
Your heart still sinks when you're handed the pair of 3D
glasses. A little bit. And you think, oh, it's going to be a dodgy conversion or whatnot. I can't see that particular bit of lightning. Phil is literally disrobing.
No, you can. Sorry, you can continue talking.
It's very distracting. I can't see them sort of catching that particular bit of lightning in that same bottle again, from a financial point of view. But more than that, I mean, is there an appetite for an Avatar sequel? Yeah, sure. I think people want to see that. Is there an appetite for 4 Avatar sequels?
Well,
I don't know.
Well, listen. I think we talked about this in the podcast probably ad nauseum over the last few years. You write off James Cameron at your peril.
Absolutely.
Is there an appetite for an Avatar sequel? Undoubtedly. But this is an Avatar sequel that would be hitting 11 years after the first one. And the blockbuster landscape has changed hugely in that time. Mm-hmm. When Avatar came out, there was only two Marvel movies that hadn't hit. Now you can't move without bumping into a superhero film, and we'll talk more about some of those that have been announced as well in a few seconds. You can't move without hitting a Star Wars film. You can't move without hitting a DC film. The Transformers is trying to do shared universes as well. The blockbuster landscape has changed almost unrecognizably, I'd say, over the last few years. Does Avatar now feel a little bit quaint? Is it fighting the battle for recognition again? Has it passed out of the public consciousness? That moment when everyone went nuts for it I mean, completely crazy over it and just loved it and embraced it and felt that it was a transportational film that took them to a different place and made them feel in an interesting way, in a new way about their lives. That's, you know, I read so many things about people who wanted to live in Pandora, going back to our opening question. I wanted to be transported to that place and felt that the 3D was so immersive and so great that they were effectively on Pandora. Can you hit that again? Can he hit it again? I mean, I wouldn't write him off because the man's a genius, and I'm sure these films would be great from a visual standpoint. Is there enough story to justify four films? I mean, he thinks there is. The number of films has swelled over the years. It was originally like two sequels, then three sequels, and now it's four sequels. I'm fascinated to see where he goes with this, because there has been a huge Avatar backlash over the last few years, to the point now where I feel that it almost doesn't have any cultural currency. So I'm really intrigued.
I wonder what it feels like to be one of the cast members of those films. You know, presumably your contract's got sequels in it, right? Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I imagine they would have thought they would have made the next one by now. I mean, how long do they need to be in New Zealand for?
I think there's going to be
four films.
It's Australia, isn't there? They're shooting in Australia, and they're also shooting in Los Angeles as well. I remember speaking to Sigourney Weaver, who said that she might not be going to Australia. So they're going to be doing bits and pieces back and forth. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting. But also, this is mocap, so it doesn't necessarily matter in the way that Zoe Saldana and Sam Worthington and Sigourney Weaver and all those people returning and Stephen Lang are going to be 11 years older than they were when they started shooting it, because they're going to be, well, for the most part, I imagine Stephen Lang will, I don't know what the hell they're going to do with Quaritch, but
no, neither do I.
They're going to be Na'vi. They're going to be, for the most part, mocapped, right?
There is an element where this has almost now moved into an entirely animated movie, hasn't it? Because, I mean, how much live action can you have at this stage?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, is it
where they go?
Is the story about, will we see Jake Sully as his human self again?
I wouldn't think so.
The last movie we ended with him porting over permanently to a Na'vi body, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was some sort of jiggery-pokery going on that stuck him back in a human body at some point. It might not even be about them. It might be about passing the torch ultimately to new generations and whatnot. But, you know, Cameron will have new fists and new beasts, and even, you know, and the technology is going to be great. The effects are going to look fantastic, I'm sure.
It's still 2.5 years away.
Yeah.
Like, that's, you said that Blockbuster landscape changed. It's going to change again between now and then.
3.5.
I just don't know how you can plan like this. You know, you need. I know you see franchises kind of sort of revitalized after a period of time has passed, but more often than not, you need to maintain the momentum, and I just don't feel like there is any. So they'll be starting cold.
But equally, the Avatar theme park is opening, which to a certain extent will give it slightly more cultural currency. You don't know. Maybe they'll plan other material, maybe TV stuff in the run-up to it. We don't know quite what their plans are. I think they will need some kind of awareness campaign to make this relevant again.
Avatar Day.
Exactly that. But then bear in mind, like Avatar, they did no marketing for that film right up until release. Like, they dropped so late.
Well, the marketing for that film almost backfired. Do you remember people were writing it off? And again,
Avatar Day was not a success.
He was written off on Titanic. He was written off on this.
Yeah.
I think ultimately you look at it and he's making the films he wants to make.
Mm.
And again, going back to this idea, as cinema goers, we have purely selfish desires. Post True Lies 1994, if you had said to us that come 2024, which, hang on, let me just do my math, that's, oh Christ, that's 30 years from now, James Cameron, one of the greatest directors on the planet, will have made just 6 more movies, and one of those will be about a boat, and the other 5 will be in space by people hugging trees, and he will take eons of time between those movies. I just sit there thinking about all the James Cameron films that we could have had in between, all the fun throwaway $300 million costing the things that he makes in a weekend, that sort of stuff. I just think about all those movies that, you know. Let's take a look at what
money
you
on the table, that there will be 5 Avatar movies.
Yes,
you really do.
Well,
they're making them back to back, so
I mean it's yeah, I think so. Will it be the biggest movie of all time again? I don't know. But I'm not going to sit here and say no, because
I am.
That's one way you get Well,
I'm prepared to put my name to that. It won't.
Yeah. I see you.
Yeah. I see your box office.
We shall see.
I think the fact they're making the back-to-back doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be five of them. Because, you know, it doesn't work that way, does it? I mean, they can, you know, it didn't work that way with The Hobbit. They can cut the story accordingly, you know.
That is true.
It needs to... I think it needs, you know, it's going to be expensive to market it regardless, so we shall see.
Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5 maybe coming your way very, very soon. And in terms of release date stuff, also announced last week in the same sort of batch of Fox announcements, came news that the X-Men franchise is moving ahead. And so we have New Mutants coming out next year. That's going to be the first of three X-Men movies to hit next year. New Mutants, April 13th, 2018. That's going to be followed by Deadpool 2 on June 1st. And then Dark Phoenix, November 2nd, 2018. This is interesting. New Mutants has been in the pipeline for some time. From Josh Boone, the guy who directed The Fault in Our Stars. And the cast is, as we know, set to include Maisie Williams, Anya Taylor-Joy, possibly James McAvoy as Professor X. But, you know, maybe not, who knows. That's an intriguing one. Deadpool 2, we all know about. Josh Brolin and Ryan Reynolds run around looking at the camera. It's great, isn't it, when you do it now? You're doing a movie like that. It just means you can mess up as an actor and start looking at the camera and just pretend that you meant it. Then there's Dark Phoenix. Now, Dark Phoenix is the wild card here.
Yeah.
Because this is clearly the next proper X-Men movie about Jean Grey going kablooey. And this has been rumoured for a while, and the rumour is that Simon Kinberg, who, of course, co-wrote the last X-Men movie in which Jean Grey went kablooey, X-Men The Last Stand, he may write and direct this one. And he has said, he was on our podcast for X-Men Days of Future Past, and he did say that he feels he has something to atone for. But that's intriguing, don't you think? I mean, Apocalypse wasn't well received, wasn't a terribly good film.
I love the X-Men movies. Apocalypse has shaken my faith somewhat. So I enter this with some trepidation, which I have never really had before.
You mean the main X-Men movies? Because either side of Apocalypse, obviously, with Deadpool, which is very, very good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Logan, which is also very good.
And they share the world, but I don't see them in quite the same light. You know what I mean? I'm thinking from a pure X-Men point of view. But we'll see. Dark Phoenix is a really interesting story. Jean Grey is a great character, and Sophie Turner plays her very well. So.
Isn't it too soon?
She hasn't earned the right to be Dark Phoenix yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's an element of that. There is an element of that. But... you know, let's see what they do with it.
Yeah. And where it's going to come, we think it's going to come 10 years after Apocalypse, so somewhere in 1992, 1993, which is around about the time, weirdly enough, that Jim Lee's X-Men number one with Chris Claremont hit and sold 8 million copies and everyone went nuts and went, comics are here to stay. So I don't know, it could be
intriguing. Character ties maybe aren't developed enough to give it the impact that it would otherwise have.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, because with Marsden and Falcon Janssen, you know, there was a character bond there that you saw. I mean, it wasn't handled well, don't get me wrong, but at least they had earned
Cyclops
something.
Being killed off screen.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like, at least they had some character sort of like interconnect there. I don't know that we've seen that or really felt that.
Yeah, I don't think we've earned it. I think it's a little bit... here we are. Every day's Christmas Eve at Empire. You know, but... I feel that if they go Dark Phoenix in this film, it's a little bit like with Star Trek Into Darkness, where you didn't earn the emotion of Kirk's quote-unquote, air quote, death and Spock going kablooey himself. You didn't earn that. And I feel that you need another movie with Scott and Gina at the forefront, because I don't know whether Jennifer Lawrence and Michael Fassbender and McAvoy and all those and Nick Holt are going to come back. You'd imagine, for the most part, probably not. So I think you just need another movie with these guys fighting something else. Phil, you're a massive X-Men fan.
You love them.
It feels like you're like
I really like Logan.
I conditioned you to just do that.
Yeah.
I love them.
You push my button there, Chris.
I love it.
I've been swimming in raw sewage.
I love it. I love them, Chris. Let me tell you how much I love this franchise.
What's your favourite X-Men movie?
Blue Man Group. No, I like X2.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to tell you ones I like.
Go on.
Okay. X2.
Yeah.
Don't like X3.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not a film, is it?
No. It is a film. It's a real film.
All right. Last Stand is not a good film.
You're on safe ground.
Yeah. Okay. I like Days of Future Past.
It's good. Yeah,
it is good.
I didn't like the. I thought the Armageddon one was dreadful.
What one was that?
Apocalypse. Yeah. Of course, listeners, I know what these films are called. I'm just playing the fool. No, Apocalypse was really bad. First Class, I could pretty much take or leave.
Okay.
And I thought Logan was terrific. That was my favourite by miles.
There you go.
But I didn't feel like it was quite the same as the others.
That's great.
I haven't seen I've seen Wolverine, the one where he goes to Tokyo. I thought that was Wolverine. Pretty ordinary. And the one that everybody really hates.
You haven't seen that one?
I haven't seen that because everyone really hated it.
Have you seen the first X-Men movie?
Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah.
It's decent. It's
fine.
Yeah. But two's better.
Deadpool? What do you sound Deadpool?
I really like Deadpool. No, hang on. I really liked Deadpool when it was Ryan Reynolds doing Deadpool. I thought when they started to do Colossus and all of that nonsense, I wasn't so keen.
Join us next week when Phil will be going through the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Come on, we can start if you like.
No, we can't. We've got just 15 of them.
For the Dark World.
There's 15 of them.
What's going on there?
Oh,
correct.
Yeah.
What's going on?
What are we talking about?
I have no idea.
Okay.
X-Men, in
favour, more like Logan, more R-rated X-Men movies with more jeopardy, more stakes.
Okay.
And more grounded, definitely. And I thought, yeah, very much not like Apocalypse, which was horrible. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Okay, so speaking of James McAvoy and things he may or may not be connected to, here's one we know he is connected to. Maybe I should have rephrased that differently because that's going to be a spoiler. This is interesting. Okay, so if you don't want to know anything about Split and a potential movie coming up that is connected to it, and you haven't seen Split because this has caused a little bit of a kickback. Not a kickback, that's the wrong word. A little bit of a blowback
kickback.
On Twitter. Kickback. A little bit of a bribe on Twitter. Cover your ears now for the next 3 or 4 minutes because we'll be talking about this. Okay, you gone? Ears covered? Right, okay. So yesterday, M. Night Shyamalan announced with a flurry of tweets his next project. His next project is called Glass, and it's coming out in 2019, January 2019, around the world, and it is a movie that is making me smile just thinking about it. It is a sequel to Unbreakable. It is a sequel to Split, and it will star Bruce Willis as David Dunn, the hero of Unbreakable, Sam Jackson as Mr. Glass, the villain of Unbreakable, James McAvoy as everybody he played in Split, principally Kevin Wendell Crumb, the bad guy from Split, and Anya Taylor-Joy, also returning from Split.
You've just ruined Split for me, which I haven't seen.
Have you not? Have you not?
No, I haven't.
Genuinely?
Genuinely. I missed the screening and I've never
When I told people to cover their ears in case they didn't
I didn't see what I could do. Like,
I haven't seen it either.
Table.
My ears
You've
are
ruined it for both of us.
With headphones.
I haven't ruined anything. Yeah. You've had 3 months to see this film. Three months.
I know. Okay? The fault is mine.
But this is an interesting thing because people are angry about this announcement. I know some people who are a little bit annoyed because they wanted to see Split and they were waiting for the DVD and Blu-ray to come out, I think, next month.
Yeah.
And now they're saying, what's the point? Well, the point is you're missing an incredibly fun performance from James McAvoy if you don't. And in my opinion, it's Shyamalan's best movie in years. It's flawed as hell, don't get me wrong, but there's a lot of fun.
But they're not saying that they don't want to watch it. They're saying they just didn't want to know that it's...
No, some of them are saying they don't want to watch it now. But they don't want to watch it now. Some people are angry with M. Night Shyamalan for announcing that he's making a sequel to Split, which tells people that James McAvoy and Anya Taylor-Joy survived that film because they think it might deprive their first time viewing of some tension. And they're also a little bit angry knowing that there's a link to Unbreakable.
He doesn't have like the Master of Suspense's knack at promoting things. See, let's be honest. I mean, you can't ruin the film before the DVDs come out. That has to be a rule of thumb for any
does
director.
It? Sure,
yes,
it,
a little bit. Yes, it really does.
I'm not saying spoilers are the 5 second rule. It's not like, like that.
It
but
really does.
On.
No, I'm sorry, but a director shouldn't do that.
Not everyone does.
You don't need to do it either. I mean, he's sending some, I mean, I really like him. He's a cool guy and I'm glad he's doing well again after some stinkers, but I mean, come on. Tweet about I'm writing a script so terrifying I've had to step away from it. Like, what is going? Is that a film about an animated, reanimated sort of devil script?
No, this is true. I know several writers who've done this. Several writers,
really?
Yeah, Shane Black once told me he was writing a horror script that was so scary that he had to write it during the day in the light, because otherwise he was freaking himself out so much. I know other writers who've had that experience as well. As a writer, you have to write stuff that either makes you laugh, moves you, or scares you. I'm absolutely right.
I've written features that reading them back.
Yeah, I mean, most of the stuff I write, I have to step away from, but for different reasons.
I will defend to the slight wounding.
Yeah, I wouldn't put that on Twitter. I really wouldn't put it on Twitter.
A director's right to announce his next movie 3 months after the previous movie has come out.
I will say that my irritation at having Split ruined for me pales in comparison to the sheer joy at knowing there will be a sequel to Unbreakable, which is by far and away the best film he's ever made.
Precisely. There we go, Mr. Glass half empty. Who knew it would be James?
Hey. It would they call me Mr. Glass. Half full.
Unbreakable is a fantastic, fantastic film. People have been asking about a sequel to it for ages. It did pretty well at the box office. It didn't do well critically at the time. I think there's been a massive reappraisal of Unbreakable. I think it's as close to masterpiece as you're going to get in the Shyamalan I think it's absolutely fantastic.
It's a top-tier superhero movie.
It is a top-tier superhero movie as well, with interesting things to say about comic books and superheroism and mythology and all that sort of stuff. It's a great film, and Bruce Willis and Sam Jackson are great in it, and I'm really intrigued to see how these characters and these worlds marry. You have David Dunn, indestructible, impervious to... he's like... He just reminds me of that scene from Naked Gun. Impervious to everything but water.
It's true.
Yeah. He has the same weakness as the aliens in science.
Yeah.
You just throw glass of water in his face and he's in trouble. You have Sam Jackson as the mastermind with the brittle bones. And then James McAvoy, but he becomes at the end of Split, is very interesting as well. So you go and see Split. Go and see it. It's a lot of fun.
It's not out anymore, Chris. It's just insensitive. You're just compounding things.
I'm
looking forward to seeing it. Like James, I think we're keen to see the film even now you've ruined it. And I'm excited by this news. I'm just saying that you can announce a film without necessarily letting your excitement about how clever you are
What would you recommend he do?
I just say announce the film, and then at a later date when people have had a chance
announced it as a sequel to Unbreakable and left the fact that it was
Split.
But then everyone who'd seen Split would be going, okay, so is James McAvoy going to be in it? Because that's pretty heavily hinted at the end of the last one.
And he neither confirms nor denies until a point down the line when marketing prescribes that he does.
Okay. Colin Firth is in Kingsman 2.
Yes. Yes, he is.
Yes, he is.
As we know from the trailer. The
trailer broke this week. Yes. That's all I had to say. That's literally all I had to say on the matter.
Yes, he is.
He was dead, but he got better.
He did. And lost an eye.
He's lost an eye.
He's lost an eye.
We should talk about something that's going to affect everything in this podcast.
Colin Firth being in Kingsman 2?
Us moving offices. No, we're moving offices, but that's not it. The writer's strike.
The writer's strike, yes.
It's looking likely.
Looking very likely.
Last time there was a writer's strike, Quantum of Solace happened.
and many crossed. Other things. I mean, the fallout from that was enormous.
Yeah. And it will be again.
The writer's strike is a scary thing. It's a thing that it is possibly happening. The WGA want more money from the studios and the Producers Guild, is my understanding, in terms of their deals. They don't feel they're being compensated well enough for their efforts. And it's just very, very true. A lot of writers don't make a lot of money and they don't get a lot of income. And so the Writers Guild is there to protect these people with residual payments and insurance and health insurance and all this sort of stuff. This is in the States, of course. So it looks like the WGA is voting overwhelmingly to go with the strike. And the only people who can afford it is the studios. If they decide to up their offer to the writers for the next few years contractually, then that could afford a strike, which I think could be disastrous. The last writer's strike went on for a period of months. Mm. And in that time, you have a number of films that were absolutely adversely affected by it. Quantum of Solace is one that, you know, they've been very public about it. Mark Foster and Daniel Craig have been very public about it. Because what a writer's strike means is literally that. If you don't know what it means, anyone affiliated with the Writers Guild of America cannot in any way write anything for any medium while the writer strike is under. Is
not even
is,
a birthday card.
Not maybe a birthday card.
As long as they're not being paid.
If people write checks, precisely. And in that time, they obviously don't get paid either. So it's a tricky one for the writers as well.
What happens as well is like they'll rush out scripts to get them finished because they need to be done, but it means you can have no shooting revisions, you know, while you're doing it. It doesn't just affect films, TV series. I mean, last time, the impact on TV was enormous last time around. Like, it was Hero Season 2 was completely destroyed by it, as were a number of other things. Lots of series were cut short, seasons were skipped, episodes were terrible. It's basically the apocalypse for entertainment.
Didn't Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart and I think some talk show hosts struck a deal to because they need writers every day to write their material and their monologues. Some of them didn't, I guess. But yeah, it's certainly interesting. And it led to a situation, for example, on the first Star Trek, 2009, I read an interview, an old interview with Kurtzman and Orci last week, where they were saying that they were producers on Star Trek and they would come into scenes on set and they weren't entirely 100% there, and as writers normally they would go, all right, okay, fixed, but they couldn't, and so they had to, as producers, kind of go, well, there's nothing we can do about this, and just hope that the actors would somehow come up with the goods themselves.
Can they not call an audible?
What?
Well, if you're not actually writing, could you not say, maybe reword that, say like do like a charades thing? First word sounds like.
But that's the thing. I don't think they can. No? I don't think they can even go. Well, I mean, if I were to be writing this scene, which of course I'm not legally and contractually, I would probably have Kirk say something like this, wouldn't you, Chris Pine? It was Chris Pine's idea to say that line. It's tough.
Can you have a loud conversation with your co-writer, which broadly echoes the themes of what's happening in the scene?
Apparently not.
No, they're quite hardline about it. Yeah. They are quite hardline.
So I'm concerned, I have to say, because again, we're talking about how the landscape of blockbusters has changed over the years, and now there are so many more.
Yeah.
And you have, I mean, just off the top of my head, Infinity War they call it that, Avengers 3 in production right now. What's going to happen there? I mean, it's interesting. You have what else is being filmed right now? Huge movie, Star Wars 9 is heading to production.
Which now
soon-ish.
has a date.
Yes.
Yes, which is May 24th, 2019.
Absolutely.
Until it slips back, which it will.
You know, Han Solo is in production right now. We have Jurassic World 2 in production right now. We have lots of, you know, lots of DC movies about to head in production. But what's going to happen to these films? It's very interesting. But from an ethical and moral standpoint, it is absolutely the right thing to do, in my opinion. So more power. More power to the people. I feel like Robert Lindsay and Citizen Smith. But more power to them.
Wow.
But I also hope it doesn't happen.
Yes, so do I, just for the sake of my own personal entertainment.
So in other things that probably won't be made, Michael Mann is his intriguing television project.
Is that what it's called?
It's called an intriguing television project. Subhead... Vietnam War edition. It's based on a book by Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down, and it's called Hue, 1968, set during the Tet Offensive in Vietnam. And it's a sort of an eight-part, potentially eight-part, sort of hour-long TV mini-series set from multiple perspectives during this battle, the battle depicted in Full Metal Jacket, the end of Full Metal Jacket. And set from, I think, both sides of the combat, and he is, I guess, looking to shepherd that to the screen. It could be kind of a Band of Brothers type scenario, which I think is pretty exciting.
Yeah,
personally,
it's great.
Interested in what Michael Mann would do with that material.
He's directing the Ferrari film, isn't he, Michael Mann? So he is. It's not like a case where he can get movies made. Hopefully, we're not in the situation where Michael Mann can't get movies made.
God, no. I hope not. I mean, I don't think he's finding that easy.
I liked Black Hat. I did. I'm the one who liked it.
You're the guy.
I'm the guy.
You're that guy.
Bless you.
And in a sort of similar kind of director, status-wise, David Fincher and Brad Pitt.
Yes.
Interestingly.
World War Z.
Interestingly.
Thank you. World War Z.
World War
yes.
Z.
World War Z.
No, we're
damn
not Americans. There's no Zs in England.
Precisely.
I mean, who'd have thought that this film would A, be made, and B, attract David Fincher? No, I didn't mean that glibly. I mean, we just didn't think there would be another one. I mean,
well,
you mentioned
doing,
Mark Forster.
Well, doesn't he?
Terrible time.
Hmm.
Yeah. and it would appeal to David Fincher.
It feels to me like they've almost gone, well, we had such a terrible time making the last one. That's wait until there's a writer's strike, guys, and then we'll really cripple ourselves this time. Let's really hamstring ourselves. Let's go for it. let's make it really challenging, shall we? I'm very excited about this. This was mooted a few months ago, actually, and everyone poo-pooed it. I poo-pooed it. I mean, why would David Fincher waste time with a bunch of fast zombies? But maybe he likes them, and he works very well with William Bradley Pitt, so why not? Why not?
I'm going to poo-poo your poo-pooing in the style of Flying Laurie. Jim Giannopoulos, the new head of Paramount. This looks like it's his first kind of move. I was going to say strike, but that's probably not the right word to use. He's got a good relationship with David Fincher, so I guess he's lured him in. I think this could be awesome. I really like the first film.
I like the first film.
And
yeah.
The book gave lots of different interesting directions that the second film could go in. So, actually, fingers crossed.
Yeah, absolutely.
I reckon.
See what happens with that. And some more stuff to race through very, very quickly. It looks like a movie that's been... I remember reading about this movie in Empire magazine. It feels like an eternity ago. Gemini Man.
Yes.
Do you remember? This is like one of the hottest... It was one of the hottest scripts in Hollywood when it first debuted. And I think it was written back then by Jonathan Hensley, who wrote Die Hard with a Vengeance and the Thomas Jane version of The Punisher. He directed that as well. Married to Galen Hurt. There's a bit of trivia for you. And it is about a hitman, an older hitman, who finds himself in the fight of his life against a younger version of himself. They clone a younger version of himself and they send him into action. And, you know, it's about, can this guy's experience and chutzpah overcome this younger fella's moxie and athleticism.
And Moxie and chutzpah sound like a great double act.
They do, don't they? They're probably even the same thing. Who knows? Anyway, but and so it's been linked with lots of A-listers have been linked with it over the years. Harrison Ford and Mel Gibson. Back in the days when Mel Gibson was an A-lister. And it's never quite got to the starting line because they weren't sure about the technology. But as anyone who's been to see a Marvel movie recently, if you're going to see Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, it's not a spoiler to say it begins with a really freakishly accurate younger Kurt Russell in the opening scene. We see a 1980 Kurt Russell, and it is, I mean, it's like they went back in time.
It's pretty terrifying.
And shot him. So the technology is there now. You could do this. And Will Smith is the person who is circling this to play both roles.
Yeah.
Which he may or may not take if
for
he decides
potentially
to. Yeah.
Ang Lee.
That's the other thing.
Ang Lee. What? I mean, that's a strange...
Well, Jonathan Demme is a director you can't pin down.
No, you can't pin down Ang Lee. No, you can't.
You can't. He won't let you.
I tried just the end of last year. Slipped away.
You can get him in a headlock.
Yeah, no.
But he's just...
You can't.
He digs his elbows in and off he goes.
You gotta chain him to something.
Yeah, up the walls, over your head.
Shapeshifter.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'm very excited. And Jerry Bruckheimer producing. That's like the holy trinity, isn't it? Will Smith, Jerry Bruckheimer and Ang Lee.
The heady days of sort of Don Simpson excess. Ang Lee, just get him out. Where is he? He's in his trailer with
This sounds like a proper Jerry Bruckheimer movie because he has been farting around with pirates movies and family-friendly franchises for too damn long. And it's about time we had something that was balls out and mindlessly stupid. And I think that this could be the absolute ticket.
We need someone to direct something balls out and mindlessly stupid. Who have you got for me? Ang Lee, you're fired. Okay. Could be good, though. Looks interesting.
Yeah.
Could be good. And of course, Will Smith also potentially playing the genie.
Well, apparently he will only do...
One or other.
One or t'other.
One or other, okay.
Do Gemini Man.
If you're listening, Will.
He is listening. Of course he's listening.
Of course he's listening. Why wouldn't he be listening?
Did you mention about Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic World 2?
Just mention it.
Yeah. He's going to be in Jurassic World 2 next. Yeah. not just on the cover of a book.
So you're talking about Joe Johnson directing Narnia, The Silver Chair?
That's something I didn't see coming. It just felt like that. I thought that was a franchise that they sort of quietly ushered off into retirement. He'd gone to live on a farm.
Well,
somewhere.
We thought had been ushered off into retirement. We thought Avatar had been ushered off into retirement.
Next thing, you'll find like The Subtle Knife goes into production. You know what? It's like the Golden Compass sequel. Suddenly, it's back from the dead. It took down one studio. It's coming for the rest.
Yeah, no, I think that one's...
Or like He-Man rebooted.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Oh, wait a minute.
Oh, no, it is.
He-Man has been rebooted.
Yeah.
This news just in.
Quite terrifying.
He-Man is set for December 2019.
Yeah.
It's actually happening.
So that's why Star Wars has moved.
It's moved to get out of the way of He-Man, the master of the universe.
Yeah.
Also, there was the Zoe Saldana may have, but then probably didn't reveal the title of the second Infinity War movie, mm-hmm. when she said in her quote on the red carpet at the premiere, oh, then we're going back to shoot Gauntlet, to which everyone thought, oh, it's going to be called The Infinity Gauntlet. Mm-hmm. And then James Gunn said, in, if I'm honest with you, a not entirely convincing quote. No, that isn't it. What's that behind you? I'm going. Bye. That was pretty much his quote. He denied that's what it was called, but it wasn't the most convincing guy.
Well, because there was a quote from Kevin Feige last week saying that the title of Avengers 4 will be a spoiler for something that happens in Avengers 3. I don't think Avengers Infinity Gauntlet is a spoiler for something that happens in 3. Avengers Tony Stark's head has fallen off is a spoiler.
See, no, we talked about this, and I think it does. I think if it's Infinity War, then Infinity Gauntlet, which, fact fans, is an inversion of the way the comics work, because it's the four-part Infinity Gauntlet comic leads into the Infinity War series. So mm-hmm. there you go. That implies that there's a fight for the stones in war, and then he assembles the Infinity Gauntlet in Gauntlet. So that gives you an idea of the arc of the story, if that is indeed the case. But his exact quote, this is Gunn's exact quote, it's not the title. My guess is that Zoe just misspoke. I'll talk to Zoe today, but I would imagine it's just Zoe misspeaking and saying Infinity Gauntlet instead of Infinity War. I mean, doing his best Sean Spicer right there. I don't believe a word of it.
I'll be having a word with Zoe today.
Yeah. But stop anyway, talking. Interesting. Stop talking about interesting stuff. You know. And what else we got? Someone was talking about there's potential rumoured possibilities, Fast and Furious Hobbs Shaw spin-off.
Yes, that's
which
right.
is an interesting one, an interesting direction. Obviously, given that Vin Diesel and The Rock are not the best of chums post-Fast 8.
Allegedly.
That's an interesting direction. Although, as someone's pointed out, that Statham is so good in that as Shaw. And if you're going to do anything else with him, it can only be with Hobbs, because he killed Han. So...
allegedly.
You see him do it.
Never see a body.
Han did not shoot first.
There is scuttlebutt that Han may return for 9 and 10.
Well, then that would kind of defuse the situation. But because he did that and because they are family, you can't see a situation where long term that team is going to work with Shaw. Can you really?
I think they're very forgetful people.
No learning, no hugging.
Captain Deckard Shaw has proven time and time again his heroism in the field of combat.
Yeah. Well, anyway, this is a film. I mean, given that Hobbs and Shaw weren't by far and away the best things in Fast 8, this is a film I would watch.
I'd also watch Kurt Russell gay crashing as Mr. Nobody, just coming in and laughing. That's what he seems to do in Fast 8. He just comes in
and cackles,
laughs at them, and then leaves.
As long as he leaves little nobody at home, I think that's fine.
I beg your pardon. Yeah. Right. Time now for the...
There's one last thing I'm going to say.
Bloody hell.
One last thing. We've done a lot of news today.
There's a lot of news.
There is. The X-Files is coming back this year for another 10 episodes. Make of that what you will, good or bad, fair or ill, it will return.
This is how much news we've had this week, that would normally provoke at least 5 minutes of discussion.
Yeah, and that's it.
And that's it.
That's all we're saying.
The X-Files is coming back. Yeah. You didn't like the last one.
It was not the X-Files at its best.
Well, maybe this will be.
It's doubtful, but yes, it might be.
Two more bits of news before we move on to this week's guest, and as if by magic, Johnny Pyle has appeared to tell us about at least one of these bits of news. Johnny.
Hello, Chris.
How are you, man?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. What are you here to talk about?
I'm here to talk about the new issue. Have you talked about that already in general terms?
Yeah, last week.
But we have a new issue.
What?
We have a limited edition virtual reality issue, which is out in stores now. But only one store, in fact. It's out in Sainsbury's stores now. And only selected Sainsbury's stores at that. You can check online which ones they are. But it's very exciting. It's... you get the normal issue as standard, and then you get a VR cardboard headset for you to slot your phone into, and there are two amazing experiences, the cover says, which you can unlock. One is an immersive trip inside the Alien universe, which I won't spoil, but it's Alien as you've never seen it before, and certainly as you've never experienced it before, because you are existing in this world. And then we have a special deleted scene from the movie, which is only available again through if you get this issue.
This is huge.
It's a wonderful thing, actually, and it's in this beautiful bag with a special cover, which looks frankly terrifying. Big alien head on it.
Oh, that's an alien. I thought it was James. I always get confused.
It's uncanny. Turn to the side, James.
There you go. How's that?
Make your other mouth appear from inside your mouth. Perfect. Perfect. That's great. How much do you have to pay for this? It's not all good and evil news agents. It's one good supermarket.
One good supermarket. You have to pay $6.99. He says, checking quickly.
$6.99. That's a bargain at four times the price.
Yeah, I mean, so if you have the initial issue, then it's just mere pounds and penny, mere a pound and a penny and some pennies.
Yeah,
it's more expensive.
It's fantastic. And have you tried this yet? Have you tried the VR thing?
Yes, indeed.
Have you not tried it?
I'm terrified of things. I guess I tried VR around James's house, and it's not good. I mean, it scares the crap out of me.
It was entertaining.
And that was a football game. Yeah. So I don't know what it's going to be like with aliens coming at me. We watched Nick Desemlian fighting a shark. In VR, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, this is more terrifying by far, I would say.
Okay.
It's quite freakish.
Okay. Cool. I'm excited.
It's good. And you can also get it online if you can't get to a Sainsbury's or your Sainsbury's is not stocking it. It's James is the online guy, so he's going to tell you the exact URL now.
He's really not. It's on the site, but we don't have a special one. It'd be far too long to read out.
Something like Great Magazines, right? It's on the Great Magazines website.
It is, but you can, yeah.
You'll find it.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Good. It's gonna be a lot of fun.
You gonna buy one, Chris?
No, because I've got one on my desk. And listen, if you can get one, I'm prepared to take offers for it. So get in touch with me on the Twitter. Just DM me with a number. Like, starting with three figures is great. You can put the decimal point wherever you want, and it's fine. It's totally fine. Is this ethical? This is ethical, right?
I think it's fine, yeah.
It's fine? Totally fine. Not a fireable offence at all. Nothing. It's good, right?
You're good.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. So all very, very exciting. The VR cover is on sale right now, but listen, probably not for long.
Probably not. We've done special issues like this before. Fantastic Beasts, we had the video cover, and that went...
Like that?
Within 3 days, it was gone.
Kylo Ren action figure. Like that?
Yep.
So, get a move on. In fact, it may be sold out by the time this is released. So
it may have done. Buy it now. Invest in your eBay future.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this and it's sold out, get a Time Machine. That's our next one, right?
I couldn't
time
possibly
machine
say.
Cover.
But yeah. Stop blowing it.
All right. And there's something else to talk about, isn't there? Jimbo.
Yes, there is. We don't do this very often. We haven't done it for several years. We have once again opened the polls for Empire's greatest movies ever.
National Treasure! Vote now!
Which is gonna, it's a spoiler, it's gonna be National Treasure. But on the slight chance that it isn't, the polls are now open. We are searching for you to cast your votes for the greatest films of all time. We want your top 10 films. They will be lovingly curated by our team of
Legends.
So National Treasure, National Treasure 2.
And then they have to go to make the other 8.
Yeah.
In the next month.
Yeah. It is, you can find it at empireonline.com/movies.
Oh, he has that URL.
/best-movies.
His news story has the URL for.
Sorry, give me that URL again.
It
was quite inelegant.
It doesn't roll off the tongue. It's emperoronline.com/movies/features/best-movies. Or just go to the website and click on the features channel and you'll find it.
Is that a forward slash or a backslash? Or what is it? Is it
Philly Boots.
Yeah, okay. All right. Very, very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do not vote for Transformers this time, people. No. Okay.
If you want to vote for Nuns on the Run, you shouldn't feel you have to, but I encourage it.
What's your number one? What are you voting for?
Always Aliens. Always Aliens.
What are you voting for, Johnny? National Treasure, love aside.
I've cast my votes for Field of Dreams. Uh-huh. Stand By Me. Because I'm going to vote tactically. Because I know that people will vote for the Star Warses of this world. So they don't need my help. But Field of Dreams does. It always gets overlooked in polls like this. It should be always higher than it is. Wherever it ends up, it should be one higher, at least.
Fair enough.
If you build it, he will vote. Mm-hmm. It's a tough one with these, because you don't want to vote for obscure movies that you would normally love, because they're just not going to get on the list.
And also, Phil will do that.
Yeah, this is true. The Tree of Wooden Clogs making another appearance.
It's a very tactical.
Yeah, you gotta think about this stuff. It's all very, very exciting. So look out for a future issue of Empire as well, where we'll be discussing the results of the poll.
Indeed.
And maybe, who knows, a future podcast.
Can we say one thing as well?
Yeah.
Can we say that Godfather and Godfather 2 are two separate films?
Yes, actually, that is a very good point. Don't, please, please don't vote for the Star Wars series or Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings is not a film. Well, actually, it is, but it's an animated film from many, many years ago.
individual installments. Godfather Part 1, Two Towers, Return of the Jedi, individual films, please. Otherwise, your vote will be null and void.
Okay, there you go. I think we got it. Thank you very much indeed, Johnny.
Oh, you're very welcome.
That was a lot of fun. A lot of fun. Time now for this week's guest. He is a genius writer behind the likes of comic books like Sandman and novels like Nancy Boys and Good Omens and, of course, American Gods, which is now a major TV series which starts this Sunday on Amazon Prime. It is the legendary Neil Gaiman, Neil himself. And before Helen O'Hara ran up a big hill in Nepal, we sent her to have a nice chat with the man himself. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast, Neil Gaiman.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very welcome indeed. So, American Gods coming up. This has been in development for a very long time. Were there times when you thought it might not get to this point?
You know, I have this remarkably sort of sanguine attitude to adaptations, which is normally they will happen at the right time. Mm. And things like the Coraline movie, where I sold the rights to, you know, Henry Selick to do a Coraline book before the book was, a year before it was published.
Wow.
And it quietly took 10 years until the Coraline movie came out.
Wow.
It teaches you patience, but also there was that point where it came out at the right time. Mm. And it was the right film, and it couldn't have been that film if it had been made earlier.
Yeah.
With American Gods. When I wrote the book, I wrote it because I'd been doing a bunch of Hollywood screenplays the previous few years and was just tired of Hollywood film-shaped stories. Mm. I was tired of 120-page stories with beginnings, middles, and ends, I've been doing this now for 2-3 years. I'm really bored of this. Mm. And I'm going to go and write something complicated and all over the place and a giant rambling road trip. And if I want to put short stories in there, I can, and so on and so forth. And did that, and then learned very rapidly that meant that it was unfilmable, because I would get famous directors phoning up and saying, I want to make it into a film. I just have no idea how. And I'm like, listen, if I'd known how, I wouldn't have written that book. The whole point of the book was it wasn't a film. So from my perspective, American Gods was not something that I thought was ever filmable. Mm. And it hadn't really even occurred to me that it was could be television.
Mm.
Because at the time that it was made, nobody was making giant TV things. There was no network that could have made, something with the amount of nudity and swearing and violence that American Gods has. And all of them, I like to think, completely justified, even the swearing. But they were an integral part of what I was doing. There's weird sex in there. There's all sorts of cool shit. And then things started changing. And I was just fascinated by watching the way that things were starting to change.
Mm.
And there was a very interesting year when the people from Fremantle and I went around talking to some of the various entities that were doing television.
Mm.
And things were changing, and you could tell that things were changing. And finally we went, you know, Stars seems like a really good place to do it in America. And then we were all overjoyed once it started existing when Amazon Prime Video just swept in and said, we will take the rest of the world. You do not have to go out and sell it territory by territory. We will take it. It's like, oh, okay.
Oh, and hooray for that, frankly, because it makes it much easier for us to watch here. But, I mean, what were the biggest surprises once you got going? Because it seems to me that, you know, Brian Fuller, I mean, obviously Hannibal is one of the most stylish, weird, brilliant, surprising shows on TV. And it feels like some of that flavor is probably right for American Gods. Obviously, not all of it, but there's
What I love is that, you know, Brian has done a lot of things.
Mm.
And I don't actually look at Hannibal and see a lot of Hannibal flavor in American Gods. Hannibal is very much its own thing. It's kind of cold.
Yeah.
It's very, very beautiful, but in a distant kind of way in which the most appalling bloodshed, the most monstrous things, the darkest human beings, that they're almost moving around in this kind of peculiar erotic dance in which everything is beautiful, but very, very chilly.
Yeah.
And American Gods is this sort of hot, warm immediacy. It's everything's dirty. Mm. Everything's got edges to it. Everything's funny. I mean, there is the humor is dark, but by God, it's in there at all times.
It definitely is. We just watched, for the benefit of those listening, we just watched the scene in a bar with a character called Mad Sweeney. He's very close to my heart. My mother is a Sweeney. She's not mad, as far as I know. But there is definitely some blood and guts here, as well as, you know, as well as God.
There is. And I mean, I think that for me, in terms of what I took from Hannibal and Brian, was just Brian's commitment to go for whatever was necessary to make the right thing.
Yeah.
And so with American Gods, it would be safe to say that even in the first 8 episodes, which is the first season, there are sequences which had widely been thought to be unfilmable, where Brian's attitude was, no, we just do it as written. And then he wrote the script. I'm going, well, this is just what I wrote. And he's like, yeah. And then they shot it. And I'm going, you shot that thing that I wrote that was unfilmable. They're like, yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to give away any spoilers here, but I feel like the character Bilquis might be involved in one of those.
That definitely is.
Yeah.
Yatida, who is an amazing actress, and they pull off that scene and you go, I can't believe that I just saw what I just saw.
I mean, speaking of spoilers, for anybody who hasn't read the book, should they start now? Should they be getting after this right now before it starts?
There are two answers, and they're both true. Mm. Speaking, obviously, as the author of the book, yes, you should go out and you should buy a copy of the book. Truthfully, I don't know. We've tried to craft it in a way where if you are somebody who loves the book, you will enjoy this journey because lots of the things that you love are going to come along. But we're also planning to surprise you.
Yeah.
You have an advantage over people who have not read the book, but you do not have necessarily the advantage in everything that you may think you have, because we are going to go, though we will hit all of the high points on the way, we'll go to some other places. And also because one of the great things about the book is one thing that became very obvious to us early on is, and that I remember suggesting to Brian, and what they did was better than anything I could have hoped, was, for example, Laura, Shadow's wife, who is dead, pretty much as the story begins, and then in a variety of peculiar ways sort of comes back into the story. In the novel, you only see her really coming back into the story from Shadow's point of view.
Yeah.
You have no idea what's happening when she's not on the page. And what's incredibly fun is, you know, episode 4 is Laura's story. And it starts the week before she met Shadow. And it covers the 4 years that they were together. And it covers what happened when he was in prison. And it covers her death, and it covers everything that happened after her death. And it's like, and now she's a player in the story. And we follow her just as we follow Shadow and Wednesday, just as we follow various other characters.
Mm.
So there's a sort of a joy where we have a lot of characters who get to come on stage. And some of them come on stage much earlier than they do in the book because we're going to be following them for longer.
What about, I mean, there are famous bits of the book that are sort of unanswered, and you've very deliberately left them unanswered, the sort of the unknown god in grey in Las Vegas. Are you planning to, you know, answer those questions in the show?
It's a really interesting question because there's things, I mean, that we aren't up to yet.
Yeah.
So we don't know. And that actually
is one of them.
Yeah. And that's something that I'm really looking forward to sitting down with Brian and with Michael and actually having the, you know, spending a few days just going, okay, how are we going to do this? Because that's going to come up fairly soon. And there are ways to do it, but I'm really looking forward to figuring out how we do it. There are characters. I found it so funny on Twitter because people keep asking me about, you know, we're really worried about the adaptation of American Gods because we don't see, we've looked at IMDb and this character is not cast. And I'm going, this character isn't in it yet. He hasn't met her yet. He hasn't met him yet. They're in our future. Not everybody comes on in the first season.
Well, that's, I mean, it's kind of a road book, a road movie book. So, you know, yeah.
And there are several road trips that are going to get made. And made with this amazing cast as well. And I have this weird kind of national pride in the fact that, you know, the lead two characters in American Gods are both Brits.
You're working on a sequel, book-wise.
But I'm being really, I'm doing it the Neil way, which is and some of it is just weird personal reasons, because really it would make an awful lot of sense for me to be really working right now properly on American Gods 2. And instead I'm actually off writing Neverwhere 2.
Also good.
But nobody's waiting for, and it isn't a giant TV series and stuff. But it's just that a lot of the stuff that I've been doing recently, especially the refugee work, and becoming a UN Goodwill Ambassador for refugees and seeing what's going on with refugees up close and just going, you know, when I built Neverwhere 25 years ago, I built it with the idea of it being able to talk about the dispossessed, being able to talk about the people who fell through the cracks, being able to talk about all of that kind of stuff. And now it just feels like I need to talk about that stuff more than ever. And I have a machine here that exists. So I'm going to write this book and get it out of my head so that I can write whatever the next one is.
Yeah. That seems entirely reasonable, entirely understandable.
Having said that, Brian and Michael are the only two human beings on Earth who know stuff about American Gods 2.
Right.
And they had to know stuff because there are lines of offhanded dialogue in American Gods 1, in American Gods, that are built, that I wrote to mean different things and to echo and to make people go, oh my God, he knew what he was doing. When I got to to the second book, which then I promptly never got around to writing. So I had to say to them, okay, this is the overall plot. This is where it's going. Mm-hmm. This is going to become important. This character, who is very minor, is going to become very important. And this thing that character says is, so I need, you know, you can't cut that out just because it doesn't look important. You can't lose that line of dialogue just because it looks like it's a little grace note.
Yeah.
Just leave it for me because we're going to need that in season 5.
It's good that you're thinking ahead, though. That's really good. Well, listen, Neil Gaiman, thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you.
So that was Neil Gaiman, and let's segue seamlessly into this week's movies, which is dominated, of course, this week by Guardians of the Galaxy Fall.2. I think that's the name of the film. So, they're back. The Guardians are back.
They certainly are.
Little hairy man, tree bloke, all of them.
Yeah.
Tell us about this.
They are about this is indeed Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2.
Oh, Volume 2.
Volume 2. Volume 2.
That was Vol.
It's like
2.
It's like, well, yes, it is technically, isn't it? And this reunites us with the crack team of Interstellar Commandos while they are on a mission to what?
Interstellar Commandos.
I'm calling them Interstellar Commandos. They have guns. They're interstellar. It's fine.
I guess they are a bit like the A-Team.
Yeah,
they're mercenaries.
Like yeah, guns for hire.
Yeah. Okay.
Guardians for hire. They are on a mission to protect some light bulbs from aliens at the beginning of the film. That's not a joke. and it kind of spirals out of control from there. This is an interesting one because it's very much about the characters, this film. These are fantastic characters. In many ways, and don't attack me, the MCU's best characters in that they are the most fun to be around. They're a wonderful dynamic between them. They've got great chemistry between them. And this, for me, is a fantastic film about spending time with these awesome characters. The plot itself is slightly less grand, galaxy-spanning and Infinity Stone acquiring than Guardians of the Galaxy 1. Obviously, this stars Kurt Russell as Ego, the living planet, who turns up to tell Peter Quill that he is, in fact, his dad. And would he like to come home with him and literally play catch? We've got Michael Rooker returning as Yondu, head of the Ravagers. We have a subplot there. But this is Star-Lord's sort of journey and his sort of bonding with Russell. But as I say, this is more... I mean, what did you think? I found this was very much a film about... You know, it was very funny. There were some beautiful sequences in it. The one at the beginning, the musical kind of montage where they're fending off this sort of tentacled space alien. And it's sort of a Baby Groot's POV sequence where the action kind of happens, sort of faded out in the background. That's marvellous. That was actually my favourite sequence in the film.
I don't want to spoil too much. We will be having a spoiler special on this movie with director James Gunn. I spoke to him this week and asked him a lot about the developments in the movie, and there are many developments in the movie. And that will be out on May 8th.
Yeah.
May 8th, after the movie opens in the States, as is, of course, our spoiler special tradition. So do check that out. We'll be talking about the movie in greater depth there. It's high points and it's low points and it's flaws, because it is flawed.
It is flawed.
I can't really talk about it too much. I don't want to talk about it too much. But I think, you know, every time I sit down, because I'm a spreadsheet kind of guy, and write down a list of my favourite MCU movies, Guardians invariably comes at the top. It's the first movie I absolutely adore. I think it's great. It is flawed as well. The bad guy is still nothing to write home about in the original Guardians. But it's such fun. And the characters, as you say, are such fun to be around. And it has a sense of swagger and a confidence that sets it apart, I think, from the other MCU films. And for the first hour or so, I've seen this movie twice now for spoiler special purposes. Yeah. For the first hour or so, this is a wonderful continuation of that. It is about these five characters. Star-Lord, of course, played by Chris Pratt. Gamora, played by Zoe Saldana. Drax, played by Dave Bautista. Baby Groot, voiced by Vin Diesel. And Rocket, voiced by Bradley Cooper. And they're bickering and bantering and just they're squabbling with each other because they are, to borrow a theme from Fast 8, family, not just friends. And there is such fun to be around. And the opening sequence, I don't want to say too much about it, James has hinted a little bit, is just bottled joy.
Yeah.
It is... It's guaranteed to put a smile on your face. And for the first hour or so, I was absolutely, totally, 100% with the movie. And then, it, you know, to quote myself from the review, the Empire review, it remembers that it has to have a plot and be a bad guy. And it doesn't go off the rails at that point, but it does begin to lose momentum a little bit. We won't say anything about the plot. We won't say anything about the nature of the bad guy. I enjoyed the bad guy, and I think the bad guy is one of the better Marvel villains, thematically and character-wise. We'll talk about that in the spoiler special.
Indeed.
I think the last hour has got a lot of joy, a lot of real fun in it as well, because every time that there's a CG sequence where something is fighting something and both things are made of pixels and they're against a background entirely made of pixels, James Gunn has the wherewithal to cut to Star-Lord quipping it out with Yondu, or, you know, Drax and this great new character Mantis, played by Paul Clementiev, having this really lovely relationship, or, you know, Baby Groot being awesome. And it's still a lot of fun. I don't think it's quite as fresh or as fun as the first movie. I think there are a couple of sequences that are very interesting and potentially very flawed. We'll talk about those in the spoiler special as well, which is why I gave this, and we gave it, I think we're all pretty much on the same page with this one, 4 stars.
Yeah, it's great. And the humour, I think, really comes through. I mean, it did in the first film as well, but in particular, Dave Bautista, who is just nails the Drax persona, and his timing, and that's absolutely impeccable. Also, what they did with Baby Groot, where he is a demonstrably different personality, a different character to Big Groot, and there's a whole sort of wealth of comedy they managed to mine out of him as well. Really is very, very good. It's nice to see that Karen Gillan gets more to do as Nebula. That's they do some fun stuff with her character as well. And Michael Rooker coming back again was a shrewd move. He's really entertaining as well. Yeah, like you say, really good fun, great characters. Plotting wise, plot is not a strong point, but I don't think that detracts from the enjoyment.
So it's a more intimate film than the first one, which was galaxy spanning. And second time around, I think some of the flaws disappeared a little bit for me. There's still a couple of sequences I have issues with, but it's a very enjoyable addition. It's not better than the first movie, I think that's fair to say, but there's a lot to like here if you like that sort of thing. If you didn't like the first Guardians, steer clear of this one, but if you do go see this one, as ever, it's a Marvel movie, stick around in your seats, because there's not one post credit sting, there's not two post credit stings, or three,
or four.
What was that thing Helen always says? Neither two nor three is the number, whatever it is.
Well, there's five.
It's five. It's five. The exact number of Avatar films is mirrored in post-credit stings at the end of Guardians. So check it out for that. 4 stars in for Guardians of the Galaxy, Fall.2. And next up, Phil.
Yeah.
Tell me about Lady Macbeth.
Lady Macbeth. Well, you've used the word joy a lot, and there is very little joy in this movie, but that's not to detract from it in any way, because it's a really powerful piece of work. Despite the title, people probably know by now that it doesn't have any direct link at all with the famous Cawdorian more botherer of Shakespeare. It's actually based on a novel by a Russian man, Nikolai Leshkov, from 1865, called The Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk District. And it's the story of, it's transposed to Northumberland. 1865 remains the year of the setting. And it stars Florence Pugh as a young woman, sort of barely out of her teens, who's thrown into one of the worst sort of buy one get one free offers of all time from her point of view, an arranged marriage with a colliery owner, played by Paul Hilton, craggy, older and uncaring, and basically kind of confined to a life of neglect and misery in this drafty Northumberland castle home, where there's no joy. But she isn't taking any of this lying down. Florence Pugh is someone that you may have spotted in Carol Morley's film The Falling, playing opposite Maisie Williams, where she showed some of her talents in that, and she's really mesmerizing in this film. We featured her in the magazine as our kind of introducing talent last month, and she is a real breakout turn in this. She absolutely holds the screen. It's quite an austere film in a lot of ways. The director will be overshadowed because all the props will go to Pugh, but William Aldroyd, this is his feature debut, and our review likens it to Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights. It's a similar kind of thing. It's quite a modern sensibility to a classic period setting, and there's all kinds of difficult, dark moments and turns and twists in this film. It's not a plotty film, and yet it takes you in weird directions. And I don't want to say too much more about it. It's a really powerful film. It isn't joyful in the way Guardians is, but as a piece of sort of kind of non-classical, surprising period drama, with a real breakout turn, it's well worth a watch. We've given it 4 stars, and as I say, Florence Pugh is really, she's only 19 years old, but she's really really talented and puts in a super powerful kind of performance in this one. So 4 stars and a very big recommendation for Lady Macbeth.
Super powerful.
That was going reasonably articulately. That's not a word either. And then suddenly super powerful happened. Yeah. I was racking my mind for better adjectives.
I couldn't think of one. But she's not a superhero, right?
She's not revealed to be a superhero, no.
It's not part of
She can't get out of a corset.
William Shakespeare extended universe is not part of that.
It's nothing to do with any of that, no. I mean, I was watching it and racking my mind for where the original, how the original book might have related to Shakespeare, because you could say that this character is, she does exhibit Lady Macbeth like traits, you know, that character that's actually quite
so
a,
she's fun and carefree,
she's a fun loving gangster from the wrong side of the tracks.
Yeah,
she's a calculating woman, but not in the same way Lady Macbeth is in the Shakespearean iteration. She's someone that is in a very, very, you know, on the chessboard, she's kind of in a position of being in check all the time, and she's trying to work her way around, work out the angles. And that's where the film's kind of surprises and kind of handbrake turns come. Mm. And she's a very controlling, very controlled, but also quite passionate character, and a very modern woman in a, as I say, in a kind of anachronistic context in some ways. But it's a very impressive film.
Fantastic. 4 stars then for Lady Macbeth. If Guardians of the Galaxy Fall 2 does not float your boat, then go and see that.
Super awesome.
Also out this week, we have The Promise, which is an epic about the last days of the Ottoman Empire. It's a love triangle between Oscar Isaac, Christian Bale, and Charlotte Le Bon, directed by Terry George. Heavy-going stuff, again, but we liked it enough to give it 3 stars, which, as we always say in the podcast, is a recommendation. And out for one day only this weekend. If you haven't seen Mad Max Fury Road, George Miller's action, I'm going to say it, masterpiece, and you want to check it out, you got a chance to do so this Sunday. But there's a twist. It's in black and white. The black and chrome version of Fury Road is being released for one day only in cinemas across the country this weekend. I have seen the black and white version, and it's a very interesting take on the original film, which is obviously full of colour and visually stunning. And this really makes it feel more like the silent movie that I think Miller would have made it.
And he said this is, for to his mind, the definitive version of the film, because didn't he want to do it in black and white originally?
No,
he didn't.
No, not
so
really.
I just made that up.
No, yes and no, but he I think he's always wanted to make the Mad Max films since Mad Max 2. He saw a version of Mad Max 2 when it was being scored by Brian May. He saw a black and white version on a monitor, and he thought it looked amazing. And if he had his druthers, if he could get away with it and release a $150 million movie in black and white, then I think he would do it. But you know, he was always planning to make it in color. But then Warner Brothers said, hey, why don't you make it a black and white? And he went, oh yeah, very nice, I will, thank you very much.
So if you don't already have it on Blu-ray and don't have access to the colour control on your television, go to the cinema.
I don't think they did. I don't think it was quite, should we just turn down the knobs in this one? I think they've treated the image with as much care as they did with the last one. Just barely a frame of Fury Road that is manipulated in some way. So it's very intriguing. Go out and see it on the big screen, because we gave Fury Road 5 stars last time around. I'd be very intrigued to see whether people feel that the black and white version is 5 stars as well. Feels like a different film at times. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast in association with mustard.co.uk. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by the creators and stars of Mindhorn, Julian Barrett and Simon Farnaby. It's going to be a lot of fun. Looking forward to that. Until then, it is goodbye from James.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I am off to vote in the 100 Greatest Movies of All Time poll on empireonline.com. And you should too. Thanks a lot. See you next week. Bye.